generations. It's all about the burdens, the gifts, the unanswered puzzles that our parents and those who came before us leave behind and somehow become who we are. They're all parts of the mystery of inheritance in What Makes Us Up or The Apple Doesn't Fall Far from the Tree. We'll look at the nature and nurture, the behaviors and mannerisms, the tics and quirks that our families and parents pass on to us for better, for worse, and for both, on the next Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Mother to son. Well, son, I'll tell you. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it, and splinters, and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time, I's been a-climbing on, and reaching landings, and turning corners, and sometimes going in the dark, where there ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you turn back. Don't you sit down on the steps, 'cause you finds it kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I's still gone, honey. I's still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair. Mother to Son by Langston Hughes. Generations. It's the gifts and unanswered puzzles that our parents and those who came before us leave behind and become who we are. They're all parts of the mystery of inheritance. In today's Mind's Eye Radio, What Makes Us Up? Or The Apple Doesn't Fall Far from the Tree. We'll look at the nature and nurture of behaviors and mannerisms, tics and quirks that our families and parents pass on to us for better, for worse, or for both. Crows are not the most popular of birds, but poet Evelyn Thompson finds them almost human as they pursue their lives on the poet's front lawn. In her poem, Another Birthday, she celebrates a milestone in her adult daughter's life and sees parallels in the life of young crows.
Another birthday, and I celebrate you. 28 years accomplished, somehow, anyhow you could. The crow young on the lawn look almost full-grown. They follow and harry the parent, squawking and demanding food. The big crow steps around them, patiently, showing how to forage. They mimic, not knowing what is and what is not food. Hungry, it takes a lot to feed such a large body. You've stopped telling me all your woes, knowing I can no longer carry yours and mine. You lay your head down on your arms, silently. Outside, one of the young crows hunches down, feathers ruffled like a coat collar turned up against the wind. Disconsolate.
In her second poem, Courting in the Winter Sun, she looks at the mating rituals of the newly grown generation of crows.
Bright sunlight, cold drifting down from Canada, 6 inches of snow on the ground. A crow caws over and over. The oak limb stretches out flat to the ground. He flicks his tail once, twice, three times, flutters his wings, caws, and then again and again. Silence. He flies to another broad, flat limb. Flick, flutter, caw. No response. He strides up and down the limb, fussily, forages, picking under the bark. A female drops to a tree a little way off. Flicks, flutters, caws. He flies. She follows. and then again. Their calls puncture the stillness, courting, vibrant in the winter sun. This is Evie Thompson from Mind's Eye Radio.
Madison writer Norma Gay Pruitt.
My mother, Bonnie Pruitt Barton, to whom this is dedicated, passed away April 24, 2006, 1 minute after my birthday this year. The circle continues. Going through the inevitable paper, paper, paper of my life this week, I found a poem my mother, 84 years old at the time, wrote to me on some lined stationery I gave her, showing me she appreciated my gift. The first part concerns her mother, a little hillbilly woman who actually had the mannerisms and expressions of Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies. She talked nonstop, a nervous, nagging, worried patter in her old age, an unpleasant compliment to my grandfather's slow, droll asides. Had jet black hair, which she wore long like a girl would, braided and wound round her head. One could see some Cherokee in her cheekbones and a lot of Irish in her jig, a kind of clogging and river dance mix. She was superstitious and religious at the same time, loved to laugh with a giggle that sounded nervous as her chatter. My great uncle, her brother-in-law, once told me she was the liveliest girl he knew when she was young, loving to dance. Her name was Adelaide Rose Smith, Addie to everyone, and she smelled comfortably of bread and clay and chewing tobacco. Here is my mother Bonnie Sublett Pruitt Barton's poem, followed by a letter she wrote to me on another birthday. She dried fruit, picked berries. Oh boy, what a treat. We never went hungry. There was plenty to eat. We worked very hard out there in the sun. If it was raining, then we had fun. Dad had a big orchard. Our shelves were really crammed with all kinds of fruit and jellies and jams. We grew most of our food each year on the farm. The feed for the animals was stored in the barn. Sometimes we got bored, but we had a habit. We called for our old hound and went to hunt a rabbit. When we grew tired of hunting, we spent no time wishing. We picked up our poles, dug worms, and went off fishing. My childhood was tough, as childhood always has been, but oh, what I would give to live it over again. This poem warms me and saddens me at the same time. To think of her having recently remarried at the time after my father passed away in 2004 is to miss my dad, but mostly to miss the two of them together, flirting, working, always working. When I read her lines, I can easily travel down that dusty, honeysuckle and trumpet vine decorated sweet gum smelling lane, past the hillbilly special propped up mailbox and wire and branch gap that had to be opened carefully so the nails that held the wire on didn't give out and drop the barbed wire. One walked carefully since the summers when I spent most time there in Arkansas were high time for copperheads and rattlers, for ticks and chiggers, and all manner of whirring and singing and chittering and yowling wildlife out back in the woods at night where one slept in a dirt floor bedroom with a window without screens. All of this is delivered to me with the smells of an impending storm and the smells of some food and some jam and some fish being fried outside over a fire, with my uncles and aunts and cousins laughing and just messing around. There must have been music, too. My grandfather Homer was musical, but I don't really remember it. I was 3 when my parents moved north, so the part that my mother attached in her unschooled handwriting with superimposed ho now and then when she made a joke was and is very dear to my heart. Here is the P.S. to her letter. Gay, when you were born, we lived in a little house on the Oxford Road south of Salem, Arkansas. The house was owned by a lady named Lily Fudge. My parents had spent the day at our house. It was on a Sunday. Since I began having pains, they decided to stay. Granddad Woods was my doctor. His second wife was his helper. I can remember when I asked for medication, he said, "Won't hurt anything, nor help much neither. Ho." Rayburn Webb's sister Ursi came and stayed later to care for Pat, Jeanette, and Sue, and of course you, me, and Elmo. Since our landlady wore her hair cut short, as did Sue, we nicknamed Sue Lily. Ho. Just thought you would like to hear of your birth on your birthday. Happy birthday, Mom. It's so much like my mother to end my birthday letter with an anecdote about my sister. All of us, six sisters and a brother, laugh privately that our own children got nearly no airtime with mother. If one had the audacity to try to brag a bit about one's offspring, she would snatch you up quickly and begin to tell you about one of the other siblings' children's talents or triumphs. But since she did it to all of us, we know that she loved all of her 18 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, and 2 great-great-grandchildren. But she tamped us down, since to brag on oneself or one's progeny was immodest and improper. My mother, Bonnie, my grandmother, Addie, myself, all my relations, all the generations, connected by the thin, red, sweet syrup of blood. This is Norma Gay Pruitt for Mind's Eye Radio.
Josephine Zell remembers her school days in Lancashire, England, and how her teachers sowed the seeds of continuity in a time of turmoil.
When I began secondary school at 10 years old in the northern English town of Accrington, I already knew what a different life I lived from my mother's at the same age. Her mother often kept her or her sister home from school to help with the housework. She had no conception of why a child would be upset to miss school. The weekly wash had to be done by hand with a corrugated washboard and dried on a clothes horse in front of the fire. Then the flat iron was heated on the hob. Stone doorsteps had to be scrubbed with coarse bristled brushes and edged with yellow stone daily. The big double-fronted stone house, a parsonage, was lit only by gaslight from wall sconces and table lamps, whose wicks needed daily trimming. So girls of my generation knew that by comparison they were living in ease and comfort. Since my high school had been built only 5 years earlier, the young headmistress coming straight from Oxford, I felt fortunate, and my mother was ecstatic. The war was all but over. Celebrations of VE Day had been held at the local World War I cenotaph only months before, for which our primary school had practiced Land of Hope and Glory until we could sing it at fever pitch. The mood of the country was exuberant. It was a great time to embark on one's secondary education. A new world lay before us. On reflection, I find it interesting that the recurring theme I heard from our headmistress, Miss Daisy Brown, was that we should know and value everything from the past that was, in her phrase, worth preserving. In daily assemblies, she read to us from literary classics, A Pilgrim's Progress, Shakespeare, Milton, Blake, Wordsworth, sometimes the Bible. We sang a hymn. The 1944 Education Act had just mandated a daily assembly for worship in every state school. In her commentary, Miss Brown told us why these things were worth preserving. She was speaking to 550 girls between the ages of 10 and 18, and although I often understood only the gist of what was said, I knew that I was hearing wise words. On the annual speech day, when prizes were awarded, we all sang the school hymn, familiar from practice in music class, verses from the book of Ecclesiasticus, chapter 44, in the time-honored setting of Sir Hubert Parry. Let us now praise famous men and our fathers that begat us, such as did bear rule in their kingdoms, men renowned for their power, leaders of the people by their counsels and by their knowledge, such as found out musical tunes and recited verses in writing. All these were honored in their generations and were the glory of their times. And some there be which have no memorial, who are perished as though they had never been. Their bodies are buried in peace, but their name liveth for evermore. Josephine Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
In Jewish tradition, there is a beautiful custom of two people studying together, study partners. My father Chaim, whose name means life, was one of my most important study partners. One of the things he said was, quoting Hillel, "Don't separate yourself from the community." Lador Vador, from generation to generation. Never again will I feel my father's strong arms wrapped around me, nor walk at his side, bask in his smile, feel the gentle squeeze of his hand. Each of his books stood proudly in its chosen place in his library, in the cozy apartment where he sat, returning again and again to the pages of his favorite friends. The joy of studying together, exploring texts through my father's eyes, sharing my thoughts with him. Never again. The meaning of these Hebrew words, before modern times, the gift I try to give my bar and bat mitzvah students, their parents and grandparents, my legacy from my father, loving and knowing intertwined, Yodea, Yodaat. The poem Lador Vador, from generation to generation, is part of a new collection of poetry. For my book and CD, Amsterdam Days, A Journey Through Poetry, go to my website, www.jzuckerman.com. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio.
In the winter, they don't coo, coo. They squat silently, facing outward on the rim of the warm bird bath like elderly gentlemen, standing with their backs to the fire, coattails lifted. When they leave, there's an oily dust on the water shed from their feathers. Mourning doves leave us mourning them. It's very hard to change the water when it's below zero.
Watching her mother clean chickens in the 1930s was an indelible memory for Fran Rawl. Singeing the pin feathers was certainly exciting, and the explanation her mother made as to why they digested grain by using the gravel in the gizzard didn't seem too amazing. But seeing the long string of undeveloped eggs stored in the hen evidently made a vivid impression on her.
The chickens of my mother were rich with excitement. In memory, I stand with her at the kitchen sink. Her knife flashes easily. Mine can hardly find the joint. Who now can remember how to bring out the wishbone pulled later with such hopes? And singeing the pin feathers, chicken in one hand, burning twist of newspaper in the other, deftly applied here and there, and dropped into the open stove-eye just in the nick of time. The gizzard with the unlikely gravel teeth. You could put your little finger into the heart, then cut it in two. The liver, less excitement there, good for you. And then sometimes the grand finale, a real egg, or the series of yellow yolks, like a descending string of beads, infinity. This is Fran Rawl reliving the scenes of her childhood for Mind's Eye Radio.
My father always said about marriage, there was never a pot warped so bad there wasn't a lid warped to fit it.
The only advice I can ever remember my parents giving me was when I went off to college and my father warned me, don't let anybody put your hand in a basin of warm water while you're sleeping. And I'm still not quite sure what it was all about.
When I was a young girl, I realized that my mother wanted us to be more pleasant and happy when she put on the wall a piece of paper on which she had written the words, "The Lord loveth a cheerful liver." She had taken it from the actual biblical text, "The Lord loveth a cheerful giver." The sign stayed up for only 3 weeks, and then it disappeared. I never asked why.
My maternal grandmother, Yetta Winkler Schaffner, always told us that a woman always has to have her own money. My mother, Devorah Schaffner Zuckerman, always said 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration.
Here's poet John Morgan to present us two poems spanning a total of 1,545 generations.
Yes, that's right. 1,545 generations. That's 51,000 years. They travel backward in time from the birth of civilization in the 31st century to our origins 50,000 years ago. In the 31st century, the police department will be replaced by the pleas department. The pleas will be out to please people instead of police them. The pleas will have the power to arrest anyone who looks like they need a vacation. If convicted by a jury, they will be sentenced to 2 weeks in the Caribbean. In the 31st century, farm relief laws were passed to give farmers some relief from farming while a cure was being sought. Consequently, farmers began to build swimming pools in the middle of their fields. At high noon, they'd take a dip before nipping back on their tractor after lunch and began to feel more human. In the 31st century, there was no war and no pacifism, no isolationism, and no interventionism. Countries regularly invaded each other with unarmed armies, bearing armloads of clocks, chickens, olive oil, whatever people could use. On holidays, they would bomb each other with boxes of toys, musical instruments, poems, and cherry pies. In the 31st century, there were no summit meetings. The leaders of the world got together once a year, jumped in a big swimming pool, and got drunk, and never talked shop. This way, peace was preserved, and people who were made uncomfortable by peace gradually said they supposed they could tolerate it. In the 31st century, it was concluded that economics was the science of measuring everything carefully to make sure that some people had too much and some people had too little. So, all books on economics were converted into garden mulch. Here is a health questionnaire from the 31st century. Have you been vaccinated against politics? Do you wear rubbers against religiosity? Do you carry an umbrella against ideology? Do you practice prophylaxis against prophecy? Do you guard against truth decay? Deliverance? Where would you like to be delivered? Deliver me to the 31st century. Maybe someday, in the delivery room of the 31st century, civilization will be born. 50,000 years ago. 50,000 years ago, folks didn't have a place to go. There were no ballparks and no bars, no restaurants and no cars. Oh, things were mighty slow 50,000 years ago. People didn't have any dough. They'd just sit around the cave, where they could neither spend nor save. How they survived, I just don't know, 50,000 years ago. They didn't have a picture show. They would have to rise at dawn to go and spear a mastodon. The social graces were pretty low 50,000 years ago. You were either friend or foe, and the only club in town was the one that knocked you down. We had a lot of room to grow 50,000 years ago. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
In Lynn Patrick Smith's poem, In the Toss of a Baseball, a father and son share more than a game of catch.
My 8-year-old hand could not stretch to fit the imprint of my father's palm and fingers inside his first baseman's mitt. Strangely stitched and limp as a worn-out shirt, I was amazed that with it he could so gracefully catch a baseball. On his hand that mitt held together, snaring my errant throws, the way he would shag my questions, give straight answers for me to catch. We knew how fathers and sons should talk, and tossing a baseball was like blowing kisses back and forth. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
A loud thump on the roof of my truck awakens me. My brain synapses arc indiscriminately, slowly taking in the fact of dark frost on the windshield, an aching neck, and then I'm falling to the left as my door opens, seemingly on its own. Rise and shine, camper. My father's deep, gravelly voice roars in my head. I grab the steering wheel, pull myself to sitting. Hey, Dad, timer ready? Though I'm 20 years old, a self-proclaimed radical hippie, supposedly beyond the age where I should care what my dad thinks, I scramble to present some semblance of readiness. Pretend that I've actually had 5 or 6 hours of sleep instead of 1 hour of hungover stupor. A gust of wet, icy wind sneaks past my dad and into the only slightly less cold cab. One glance at his tight lips and hard eyes tells me he's not buying any of what I give. You got some decent warm clothes, he says. Yeah, sure, I say. About the only thing I did have ready. I've been out December cod fishing enough to know that 6 layers of wool stood between me and misery. Winter cod fishing was a family tradition, spurred on by generations of cod-loving Norwegians. The only concession to 6 hours of standing on a rolling boat deck in bitter wind and frozen spray was that the boat was engineered, so the hot engine water funneled through the metal side rails. One hand on the rail, the other on a stout fishing pole, waiting for the dull weight of a 30-pound cod. All right then, Dad says. Get a move on. I'll order you up some eggs at the seaside. He closes the truck door. Just the word eggs turns my stomach and makes me instantly regret last night's marathon of chasing beer with tequila. I dimly recall a 4-in-the-morning drive to the bitter end of Long Island, 40 miles of following blurred taillights and straddling the white line, At one point, the rumble of gravel and rocks beneath my car woke me up before I completely rolled off the shoulder. My nose is numb and running. I turn and lean over the back of the seat, grab my quilted duckskin overalls and Norwegian fishing boots. Shades of the day when I dug clams for a living. My answer to avoid working with Dad and my brothers on the construction site. Being the youngest on the totem pole, I was the official humper, lugging 70-pound bundles of roof shingles 2 stories up on a bowing wooden ladder to my brothers on the roof. Usually my brothers are here for the annual squarehead codfish derby, but Greg, the oldest, is out to sea somewhere in the Mediterranean with the merchant marines, and Kirk is on the other tip of the island, the Bronx, with his new city girlfriend. These days I feel far away from the family, and especially my dad. When we do get together, we argue a lot, usually political stuff, he the capitalist, me the Marxist. My road these days leads directly out of the family, or at least far enough away that I can see who the hell I am. Yet here I am, freezing my ass off out of some loyalty thing. I struggle against the confines of the truck cab to pull a hooded sweatshirt on, then open the door and stumble out into the parking lot. A gray, dull world surrounds me, pierced through with some distant streetlights and the warm glow of the diner across the road. A car full of fishermen pulls into the lot. New Jersey plates. Probably left Jersey at 1 a.m. to drive the entire length of Long Island in order to make the 5:30 push-off. Strange thing is, most times they spend the day drinking whiskey in the warm cabin, then buy some fish at the dock for the ride home. A lot of work to avoid spending time with the old lady. As I step into my overalls, the wind moans and rattles through the boat riggings. 4 or 5 of the party boats are lit up like movie sets, loading on bait, beer, gear for the 30-mile, 2-hour offshore run to the cod grounds. Standing next to the truck, I kick 1 shoe off, balance on 1 foot while I slip on a thick gray wool sock. But the internal gyroscope is still reeling from the alcohol, and I fall against the truck, sliding down to sitting on the gravel. Across the lot, one of the Jersey guys laughs out loud, then looks away. While I'm down, I slip on the first boot, then take care of the other. I make my way to standing and take a few deep breaths of the salt, thick, cool air, as if trying to replace the smoky, alcohol-laced air in my body with something more palatable. I get my wool balaclava from the cab and cross the gravel lot towards the diner. Why was I here? I wasn't sure. I'm thinking I should go in and tell Dad to go on without me, and I'd go back and sleep in the truck. I'm 20 and still doing what I think I should do. Not what I want. I'm pissed at my brothers for bailing on this trip. They've always covered the good son end of things. The windows of the diner are pearled in condensation, revealing only bear-like shapes huddled inside. I open the door and step inside. I realize that I've been here many times before. Not this particular diner, but dozens of others, all with my dad, on our way to work or fishing or the hunting cabin upstate. There's dense coffee aroma and the syncopated clinking of silver and china around me. A low murmur of men's voices, strong, settled, and comforting. The smell of damp wool. I'm instantly warm and pull off my cap. Other than the 2 waitresses, there's not a woman in sight, and that strikes me as something. From across the room, Dad looks up, waves me over. 2 of my uncles are with him, and my younger cousin. I make my way to the table. A full plate of eggs, hash browns, and toast waits. A chair pulled out for me. Dad reaches over and tousles my hair, and I remember why I am here. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Any community that wants to last has to keep the generations talking to each other. Esther Cameron talks about reconnecting with a lost generation and its lessons.
When I was a child, someone told me that a generation was 21 years, the assumption being, I guess, that it takes that long to grow up. In practice, we tend to define a generation by some landmark event or perceived social change. I reached the age of 21 in 1962, in time to be peripherally part of the generation of the 60s,
though held back somewhat by the values of my parents' and even grandparents' generations, which I could not entirely let go. I shared the countercultural desire to break out of whatever constraints had prevented our parents from making a better world. At the same time, I had a muffled feeling that we weren't going about it in quite the right way, that something was going terribly wrong. In 1967, I was introduced to the poetry of Paul Celan. He was exactly a generation, that is, 21 years minus 2 months and 13 days, older than I was. His generation had grown up between the wars, nourished by socialism and utopian intentions, only to experience the Holocaust. He existed in the post-Holocaust world as an isolated remnant. He felt the need to speak in a somewhat cryptic manner. What he said started me thinking, and the thinking that thus took shape has always wanted to be a form of socialism, a socialism that would leave room for individuality, that would not submerge the insight of the individual in groupthink, a socialism in which poetry would play a central role as a way of bringing individual perceptions to the attention of the community. I wondered if I was just reading this into Celan's work. And then I went back to the writers he had mentioned as his sources and found most of my thoughts anticipated in the work of the socialist Gustav Landauer. Landauer was assassinated in 1919, the year before Paul Celan was born. Celan had read him as a youth and kept reading him to the end of his own life in 1970. Landauer had not only dreamed my dream before me, he had also foreseen one pitfall into which my generation would plunge head first. From his 1911 call to socialism, I quote, "The spirit needs freedom and carries freedom within itself. Where the spirit brings forth unions like family, comradeships, vocational group, community, and nation, there is freedom, and there humanity can also come into being. But do we know, are we sure, that we can bear what is now beginning to rage in place of the spirit which is absent within the institutions of compulsion and domination which represent freedom without spirit, freedom of the senses, freedom of irresponsible lust? Can we bear this? Must not the result of all this be the most horrible torment and desolation, the most debilitating weakness, and the dullest lack of energy?" This I read as witness to a generation when the eros that should have brought forth unions, life-fostering institutions, was dissipated in mere sensationalism and exploitation, which proved quite consistent with the tendencies of capitalism. Landauer saw it all long before we were born. And nevertheless, the passage continues, "Shall there ever come again for us humans a moment of vibrant glow, of rebirth, the festival of the covenant of cultural communities, the times when song dwells with the peoples, when towers carry the united upsurge toward heaven, and great works as representatives of the greatness of peoples are created by tower-like human beings in whose spirit the people is concentrated? We do not know, and for this very reason we know that the attempt is our task. Altogether cleared away now is every alleged science of the future. Not only do we know of no laws of evolution, we even know the mighty danger that we may already be too late, that all our doing and attempting may avail nothing. And so we have cast off the last fetter. In all our knowledge we no longer know anything. We stand like primordial humans before what is undescribed and indescribable. We have nothing before us and everything only in us. In us the reality and efficacy, no longer of future humanity, but of the humanity that has been and therefore is essentially in us. In us the work, in us the image of that which is to become fulfillment, in us the need to depart from misery and meanness, in us justice, which is doubtless and unerring, in us decency that wills mutuality, in us reason that recognizes the interest of all. Those who so feel what is written here, for whom bravery grows out of the greatest need, who want to give renewal a try despite everything, they shall now gather themselves. They are being called here. They shall tell the peoples what is to be done, show the peoples how to begin. If I myself am not giving up, if I am still willing to try, it is because I hear in that voice, the voice of the ancient spirit of truth and rectitude and creative will that sounds from generation to generation. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Paul Thompson, a hunter of churches himself, tells us the story of a young cub reporter's encounter with a minister's wife who died tragically a century ago.
Joe, I've got a Halloween feature for you, the city editor of the Fort Deering Press-Gazette said to his 19-year-old cub reporter. Go over to St. Edmund's Episcopal and ask Father Smith about the 1906 murder and the ghost in the church. Your editor's got it partly right, Father Smith, a white-haired gentleman told Joe. It was a sad case all around. As far as the ghost is concerned, all we've got is reports of creaking late at night. The youth workers use the story to scare the young people when they have their annual sleepover in the church. Would you let me spend the night here alone? Asked Joe, excited by the prospect of writing a first-person story. I'd just as soon let that particular legend die, Father Smith said. But I suppose you'll write about it anyway. So, sure, you can spend the night. Father Smith gave Joe the background. The rector of St. Edmund's in 1906 was Father Gerald Hastings. It was his first parish and a challenge for him and his new wife. Ruth had spent much of her childhood at her parents' mission among the Dakota Indians. Her beauty, combined with her exotic background, seized Father Hastings' imagination and heart. Unfortunately, she had inherited her father's nature, fierce, irritable energy alternating with periods of dark despair. She was a puzzle for everyone who knew her, Father Smith told Joe. She was not well-suited to parish life, and Father Hastings' ministry was soon in trouble. Ruth was caustically tactless with parishioners, and simply dealing with her took enormous amounts of the priest's energy. He never complained, never said anything, but his face grew haggard. The congregation was split between those, mostly women, who pitied poor Father Hastings, a real saint, and those, mostly men, who asked, why can't he control his wife? Her moods grew more pronounced, and she claimed that everyone, including her husband, was plotting against her. The one thing that seemed to help was Dr. Bright's patent remedy for female problems, a mixture of herbs, alcohol, and opium. Her husband found himself encouraging her to take more of the medication, as he testified later at the inquest. It made her sleepy, he said, and I think her resting helped. It certainly quieted her. What happened, Joe? Father Smith told the young reporter. Was that the poor guy was out visiting a sick parishioner. When he returned to the rectory, he found Ruth sprawled on the parlor couch, two empty bottles of tonic beside her. He checked her pulse and breathing. Nothing. Near the body, he found a note that said, I'm sick of it all. That was all it said. This is a small town, and several of the men of the church were prominent citizens. They didn't want a scandal. No autopsy was done. The note was never officially recorded. The coroner's verdict was death by overdose of medication. Of course, everyone considered it suicide, until Father Hastings accepted a position elsewhere soon after, and before too many months were out, the lead soprano in St. Edmund's Choir followed him and married him. Then the rumors started. People began remembering her wild accusations. It was said that the priest had deliberately laced her medicine with some poison, or suffocated her and planted the bottles of tonic. He forged the note, so the story said. Father Smith smiled at Joe. As I said, a very sad case. I don't think you'll find any ghost. I've been here late at night and seen or heard nothing. But Joe saw prospects in the story, even if nothing happened. He could always give his story a comic twist. He wouldn't mind being the next Mark Twain. So he sat alone in the church that night, with only the light of a candle and a red glass cylinder near the altar, casting shadows up into the fuller darkness of the rafters. In the stained glass windows, faintly lit by street lamps, leafless tree branches cast their own shadows over the saints and prophets. There were creaks as the church contracted in the frosty October night, and the sound of a mouse scurrying. The noises startled him, but they were nothing out of the ordinary. No echoing footsteps, no screams or plaintive cries, no rushing wind, but a gradual chill. He rubbed his hands together. Although he was not a religious person, the church seemed to demand some reverence. He tried to pray, but who or what was he praying to? He didn't know, and tried thinking about his girlfriend instead. She was something he could hang on to, literally. Then he wondered, what if she turned out to be like Ruth Hastings? How could you deal with someone like that? Suddenly, all his relationships seemed a little frailer. If that could happen, to the wife of a priest, no less, why, almost anything could happen. Was that why people needed a God? Something beyond chance, beyond change? Deep thoughts for a cub reporter. The chill grew, and he huddled in the pew with his hands under his arms. The candle flickered. Why did it do that? Joe found himself listening intently. He thought of Ruth. What was that Bible passage, Ruth amid the alien corn? Ruth, who must have had dreams as a child, left only with despair and a husband who plied her with opium. Ruth, alone in the silence of the rectory, pacing or lying there, a fallen tigress. The candle flickered again, a stray draft from the stars high overhead, stars that drifted through the eternal desert of space, flickering out like candles, leaving only the dark. Cold. Ruth in darkness, Ruth screaming silently, drowning in her black well. No one to rescue her, a distant or absent God. Alone with a bottle of opium. The final note, I'm sick of it all. Joe felt the cold enter his heart. Her ghost was here all right. The ghost of everyone lost, the ghost of nothingness, the dark heart of life. I'm sick of it all. The universal sickness. Father Smith shook Joe awake. The early morning sun was shining through the saints and prophets. The candle still burned. Well, did you see your ghost? Joe shook his head. What he had seen, what he had felt, was impossible to say, impossible to write about. The Press Gazette loved to run dramatic but uplifting stories about disasters. 20 coal miners might be lost, but the story focused on the heroic rescuers and plucky families and the one survivor, the miracle of the coal field. Maybe Mark Twain could have told Ruth's tale, found the right twist, produced a thrill, a chill, a laugh. But Joe couldn't. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
A common misconception is that information flows only from older generations to the younger. In fact, the younger generations are curious, smart, inventive, and live in a different world. They have a lot to offer the older if listened to and observed. Dr. Stringlove relates an incident in which he learned from his grandson.
Hello, Dr. Stringlove here, out on the open road. I don't have to sit in the science corner of Mind's Eye Radio for the time being. As you know, lane selection is crucial when driving on freeways and multi-lane boulevards. Choosing the wrong lane can lead to exciting merges into fast-moving traffic or frustrating you-can't-get-there-from-here detours. Freeways can be really challenging since lanes are often created or destroyed at the whim of the highway department. In Houston, I found it common to start out on one side of the freeway and eventually wind up on the other without changing lanes, even from the far left lane to a mandatory exit on the right. The correct choice of lanes is even more important when driving in the San Francisco Bay Area. Actually, I've become pretty good at this out there, especially when I have a passenger who knows the route. On one such trip, I learned an interesting lesson from my grandson, who was 11 or 12 at the time. I'm used to driving in a middle-sized Midwestern city and always use my turn signals for turns and lane changes as required by common sense and even the law. Out in California, my grandson and I were going from one of the many contiguous suburbs in Marin County to another along well-marked wide boulevards. After about the third time I moved into a left-turn-only lane and hit the blinkers before I turned, my grandson said, "Grandpa, you don't have to signal here." How true, if you only have one option and everyone knows what it is, you don't need to reveal your intentions. This is Dr. Stringlove slamming on the brakes for Mind's Eye Radio. Why didn't that other driver signal?
Touching the Generations.
Poet Kathy Miner.
My child lies flushed and feverish, not seriously ill, but uncomfortable. I sit on the long edge of his bed, offering what solace I can, and without conscious direction, begin to stroke his hair, his small scalp damp beneath my fingers. Despite the room's warmth, I grow goose flesh, for though no one else is there, I feel a touch upon my head, and my hair, too, is caressed in rhythm. In a flash of pure and wordless understanding, I know it is my mother, though many miles distant, who tenderly strokes my head, etching love into my consciousness, helping me feel better, soothing me to sleep. I can only know to do this now if it was done for me, and she must have known from her mother, and so back and back and back again, unnumbered generations. Surely it will carry forward as well. Perhaps this small one of mine, grown tall in a father, will one day sit at the bedside of his child, and without knowing precisely why, put hand to head, fingers to scalp. Perhaps he will tremble, as do I, at the power, the grace of such a simple instinct, a common act. Perhaps then he will be allowed the memory of this night and of me. It is like the trick with two mirrors. You hold one up to your nose and look in the other, and there see your reflection, and in that mirrored mirror another. And on and on and on, a tunnel of identical images, limited only by visual acuity and the size of the glass. So it is with ill children and headstroking, an endless chain of caring, of comforting, from parent to child to parent to child, linked, unbroken love, transmitted silently through the fingertips. Holding that thought in the palm of my mind, this is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
These are words of wisdom from my major professor. The first, nothing grows faster than other people's children. The second, it's terrible to be responsible for something you can't control. he said as he looked at his wife at a party.
This is Fran Rawl. Recalling words of wisdom from my mother, one of the things she used to say was, is that you spoke or the washtub broke? And it wasn't until I started thinking about this not too long ago that I thought the washtub in those days was a cast iron, huge kettle slung over an open fire in the South. If the washtub broke, it would totally put out the fire and cause a big problem. And I think words spoken in anger or without consideration. Another thing my mother used to say, it's not what you like that makes you fat. And I always thought this sounded pretty reasonable, that you couldn't always do what you wanted and have good effects in the future. My father used to say, which I don't think did me that much good, was you'd forget your head if it wasn't fastened on.
My Grandma Bee used to say, if you don't use your head, you'll wind up using your feet.
I had to learn a couple things with my in-laws, and one was when something isn't quite right or it's out of whack, they say it's focused, which just seemed wrong to me. But one thing that my father-in-law said that makes sense is he's always trying to make things come out even. He's going on 88 years old, and he's still trying to make things come out even, and I think that's why he's still going.
My mother used to say to me, very mysteriously, you can't beat the devil round the stump. I don't know what that means, you know. Something about bad news has traveled around the world before good news gets its shoes on. You've heard that one, right? And Mark Twain said, the difference between the right word and the nearly right word is the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug. I always liked that.
I learned two sayings from my mother, which I have never heard anywhere else. One, from her French peasant grandmother, was, don't throw out your black water before you have some clean. Fools' names and fools' faces always appear in public places. A sobering reminder for those of us who are bound to seek publicity. I could also quote a saying by Bertolt Brecht, if we lived forever, everything would change, but since we are transient, much remains the same.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to What Makes Us Up, or The Apple Doesn't Fall Far from the Tree, on Mind's Eye Radio. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Original music by Barbara Chusett. Contributing writers for today's show were Esther Cameron, Kathy Miner, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lewis Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evelyn Thompson, Paul Thompson, Guy Thorvaldsen, Judith Zuckerman, and Josie Zell. If you'd like more information on the show, go to www.mindseyeaudio.com, or you can listen to us on the web at radioforall.net. That's four, like the number four. Until next time. I'm Greg Willard. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.